welcome to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of Yes to Life, the integrative cancer care charity that's helping people with cancer in the UK to learn about the many ways they can help themselves if they have cancer. It's a very broad view of what constitutes good care, and it's getting broader all the while, embracing a truly holistic perspective on health. In today's show, I'm delighted to be hosting the distinguished author, Dr. David Hamilton, someone who's been pushing at the boundaries of the science of health and well-being for the whole of the time that Yes to Life has been in existence, and who has contributed significantly to a broader awareness of the impact of some of the less tangible aspects of our experience on our well-being. Hi, David, delighted to have you as my guest on the Yes to Life show today.
It's my pleasure, Robin. Thanks for having me on.
I'm really looking forward to chatting to you today, as you've invested so much energy into exploring topics that are so fundamental to healthcare, I feel, not to mention the rest of life. And you're now hugely successful author of a dozen books. And it's not too hard to recognize you've got a fascination with a few particular themes that run through them all. Of course, I'm keen to explore some of those key themes today, but I wondered if we could start out talking a little about the why and the who behind them. I speak to lots of people who tell me that, you know, they had a medical background, so they went straight into surgery, or their mum's breast cancer made them want to be an oncologist, or indeed their own experience of cancer made them decide to train nutrition. So, but what do you think were the factors that coalesced to create such a singular focus in you on subjects like kindness?
To be honest, it was my mum having postnatal depression in the mid-70s after my youngest sister was born. I have three sisters. My youngest sister was born in the mid-70s and my mum developed postnatal depression. It wasn't very well understood then, not compared to how we understand it today. In fact, what the advice my mum was given in one of the appointments she had was to just give yourself a shake. And I think asking a lady with postnatal depression to give yourself a shake, that's akin, I suppose, to asking someone with a broken leg to run it off.
Yes.
Kind of thing. And so my mum was depressed for a while and she'd struggled with anxiety, but also self-esteem. Just by feeling like stupid, feeling that she's a weak person. And I remember I just started high school. So this was about in the early 80s. And the English teacher took us to the library. And I don't think I'd ever been in a library that I could remember before. And this might sound a bit kind of corny, a bit woo-woo, but a book fell off the shelf. Maybe I bumped it in a bag or something. And it was called The Magic Power of Your Mind. And I thought, oh, and I just had an instinct that that could help my mum. So I just took it. I didn't know you're supposed to join a library and borrow books, you know, get the little yellow thing. I didn't know. So I put it in my bag and we still have the book. But, you know, it didn't cure my mum of depression and what she was struggling with in a day. But you know what it did do for her is it gave her insights and tools and strategies that helped her to find a way through some of the difficult times in her life at that time. So throughout my teenage years, because it was such a fascinating subject for my mum, mum and I chatted a lot about the power of the mind and what it means. And my mum was and still is the kindest person I'd ever known. And so the combination of my mum as a person always doing things for the family, coupled with the fact we were having these conversations about the power of the mind, it's no surprise that after I finished my PhD and I went into research and development, I worked in cardiovascular and cancer, and I developed a fascination with the placebo effect when my colleagues were excited about, you know, I mostly worked in the cardiovascular field in the earlier time there, and when we got you're looking at results of drug trials and my colleagues are looking at how well the drug's doing. And my mind just kept coming back to, that's amazing that people are responding to the placebo. Because bear in mind that I had never had any exposure to the placebo effect other than something mum and I had talked about. So actually seeing it in numbers and stuff was the first time I'd actually ever thought about it, really, other than just, you know, the science of the mind. And it was just so fascinating to me. So I started to explore the mind-body connection while I worked in the pharmaceutical industry. And that ultimately, a few years later, was my springboard out when I decided that what I really wanted to do was write and research and educate about the mind and kindness. Because actually getting into kindness was a side effect of that, because I came across some research on a compassion kindness-based meditation. And they measured inflammation in the body in the same way that I was familiar with measuring inflammation. You measure the levels of certain substances. And I was astonished to see that a compassion, kindness-based meditation was having such a sizable anti-inflammatory effect. And that just opened up, you know, kind of worms for me. So I think those combination of factors steered me in the direction that I've gone in the years since.
Mm. How interesting. Yeah, the placebo effect, you're right, is absolutely mind-blowing, really, isn't it? And of course, it's just an accepted part of the pharmaceutical industry where they just put it in there, you know, and nobody thinks about it at all.
Yeah, and what actually happens is when you take a placebo that you believe is a drug, you have an expectation of what's supposed to happen. And that expectation actually causes your brain to use its available resources to meet that expectation. So in terms of, say, pain reduction, if you take a placebo, you think it's a painkiller, but it's secretly been swapped for a placebo. Your expectation based on previous experience is my pain will go away. So your brain says, okay, how do I meet that expectation? And the way that it does is it releases its own painkillers, which are called endogenous opioids like morphine. And so the brain uses its available resources to meet the expectation you have, obviously within reason. And that is what underlies the placebo effect.
Mm, amazing, amazing. Yeah. And the other thing you were referring to there is really the testing aspect, which has grown exponentially in the time you and I have both been doing stuff.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It means that all this stuff, which was previously just a load of woo-woo, we can actually measure it now. And it's become science.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it's become accepted science, but it's become science. Yeah, getting there, exactly. So, yeah, kindness seems to be a really central topic for you. Now, there are lots of people around who at best would rank kindness as a nice to have, basically as entirely unessential, and maybe even an obstacle to other more important factors like efficiency, for example. But for you, it's clearly central. And can you explain exactly why you feel so passionate about the centrality of kindness to the expression and the experience of our lives?
Well, I think we're actually biologically wired to care. It's actually fundamental who we are. You know, in fact, the genes that are associated with the natural human tendency to care and to express that care in kind words and kind actions are some of the oldest in the human genome. The fact we still have them, they're at least 100 million years old. The fact we still have them, that tells us that caring, compassion, kindness is central to human beings in terms of our survival, and that our species has got this far because we cared for each other. And if we stop it, then we maybe won't get much further. We're supposed to care. And so for me, that deep understanding is what helped me start to explore the science of it, because the side effect of that is the body does not stay neutral when you're kind. If you're kind, whether it's something you say, even whether you're thinking kindly or so of someone or doing something kind, the body doesn't stay neutral. And what I mean by that is there's a cascade of physical effects, from an impact on your heart in terms of reducing blood pressure to an impact on your immune system. There's impacts right down to the genetic level in terms of how inflammation works throughout the body. So there's a whole host of different things that happen. And these are just what the body has naturally evolved as what you might call side effects of being kind.
Mm-hmm. Amazing, amazing. Yes, absolutely. I you know, that hardwired for it thing, it very much seems that way to me. I've never lost sight of something I saw in the 60s on Candid Camera, where this woman faked that she'd broken her stiletto heel, and she appealed to all these men for help. And some of them did the most extraordinary things to help her in response. You know, they're literally hardwired. You could see, you know, this guy carried her for miles to her car and this sort of stuff. You know, it was extraordinary. Yeah. I just thought, well, that's a natural human response to that situation.
It really is. We really are hardwired for it.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. So, yeah, another kind of related theme of yours is around this marriage of science and spirituality. This is a topic, we're all too aware of this, of course, in integrative oncology. It tries to explore this middle ground between where these two kind of overlap, merge, and start to be indistinguishable. But it's also this kind of dangerous no man's land that confronts the polarizing views that are often the loudest voices in the field.
Yeah, I
was remembering as I was preparing for this the Reith lecture that Prince Charles, as he was then, gave in 2001 exactly on this topic, and he was received with such venom, particularly from the scientific community, of course, that he should bring this up. I mean, he made it absolutely clear about science's rightful place at the table, but the very idea that spirituality should be at the same table was just like absolutely incendiary. So, you know, we have integrative medicine. It's kind of an attempt to set up camp in this no man's land between these polarized armies and to explore this territory where lots of cancer patients are stumbling around there, being shouted at from the trenches from either side, caught in the crossfire. It's been a long, hard road to build something in this no man's land, but it is happening slowly. You know, your first book, It's the Thought That Counts, was published just around the same time as we were getting going as Yes to Life. And I'm just interested to hear your perspective on how things have moved over that period in terms of our attitudes as a society.
I think there's been a sizable shift. And a lot of that comes from science looking into things that previously they hadn't done. And I think when enough, and this is one of the reasons why I back up everything I talk about with science, everything I write with science, because when you realize there's a wealth of information available, you find that a lot of previous skepticism from people isn't because they're necessarily experts about the thing they're skeptical about. It's just because they hadn't heard of it or they didn't really realize that there is actually a lot of evidence. There is actually a lot of philosophical thought or psychological thought or other scientific views and things, but there has been a lot of work done in these fields. Even when it comes to spirituality, there's actually quite a lot of work, research in how spirituality, believing in something greater than yourself, gives you a sense of peace and comfort, meaning. It gives people a sense of meaning and purpose in their life. And that can be incredibly helpful when someone is confused or struggling in their lives, to be able to say, okay, maybe I can just sit back for a little while and rest in something that I feel within myself that gives me that extra sense of strength. And when you feel that sense of strength, you get a bit more insight and clarity and almost strength to sometimes go forward in your life. And there's a lot of research into that, those aspects now, that spirituality really is very, very helpful.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, if you take a really long view, you can see that there's a sort of sound basis for this antipathy, in as much as that, you know, spirituality and science were kind of like two power bases, weren't they, in society, where, you know, spirituality had the upper hand for a very long time, running people's lives in not a good way. Then science came up as being the enlightened perspective that was going to overthrow all that dogma. You can see where it's come from. But we need to move beyond that at this point and get to something better, don't we?
Yeah, I often find you often get polarizing views of so many different things.
Yes.
And often there's so much to be found in a middle ground, like a marriage of the best and the most useful aspects of both. And sometimes I feel the way I try to approach a lot of things is sitting in the middle ground as a kind of translator, quite happy to dive into the work, the spiritual world, and quite happy to dive into the scientific world and almost translate spirituality to scientists and science to people with a strong spiritual grounding. But I've always found that there's so much to be found in a middle ground between polarizing extremes. And I think there is so much polarity. Like we always like we believe you have to be in that camp or you have to be in that camp. And in actual fact, there's so much to be had, you know, and in that middle ground, it doesn't mean you have to stand in the middle ground. You can, from that perspective, you can use the best of this side and the best of that when it's appropriate, when it's needed.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's such a great description of integrative medicine. In fact, that's exactly what we're encouraging people to do, is not to throw any of it out.
No.
Of course, there's things to offer all round. And you literally pick the best from the best.
Absolutely.
At any given time. And it can change. You know, what's a conventional approach is really good now. But actually, at this point, something outside of conventional medicine is better.
Yeah.
So, it's a moving target. And you're right. If you really want to stay alive, then actually the middle ground is the place to be standing. And so trying to push people to one side or the other is, very unconstructive for them.
Yeah.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movements and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
The station that makes you feel good.
So, I want to try and bring two of your key themes together. Our health service it's got shortcomings around institutional kindness or lack thereof, in my opinion. There's enormous amounts of kindness being expressed day in, day out, I think, in the NHS. But in a certain kind of way, it's all under the radar, unapproved.
Mm.
My perspective is the NHS is institutionally unkind, both to patients and to its own staff. Cancer patients go there, they come in the door, they're most vulnerable, they're facing what's usually the biggest threat they've ever encountered, and what they find is an institution that's more akin to the army than anything else. And the kind of care and love and human kindness they so much crave and need is a sort of subversive movement, if you like, expressed through secret signs, rather than being the overt beating heart of a care organisation.
Yeah.
So this, to me, follows from a refusal to move away from a particular interpretation of science. One that doggedly excludes, for example, any science of kindness.
Yeah.
And so I want to look at this relationship between bridging this gap between science and spirituality and the growth of kindness in our healthcare and indeed society.
Yeah. Do you know, there is a wealth of evidence. And that's the thing. sometimes science takes a while to be not just accepted, but noticed that yes. people are aware of it. I mean, there's a wealth of evidence that empathy improves patient outcomes. From
I can believe it.
Yeah, from mild things like the. In fact, here's a study. This NHS were involved in a study. I believe it was a. It was patients over 700 patients in the UK, who went to their doctor with symptoms of cold, of the common cold. Were they had to fill in what's called a care questionnaire, so consultation and relational empathy, and right. where they had to rate. Good. They had to rate the empathy level of their doctor. Now, what was amazing is those who rated their doctor a perfect 10 out of 10, they recovered 50% faster than a lot of other people, and their immune response was significantly greater. And the only difference was how much empathy the doctor showed them. And even in serious conditions, like a study of all, about 170 to 180 patients, male men with prostate cancer, again, treated with a high empathy doctor, even 3 months later, they had higher levels of natural killer cells in their bloodstream than people who were treated with a low empathy doctor. So there is a wealth of data, and there's a number of reasons. When a doctor shows empathy, a patient, one, might open up more. And they might be willing to divulge a little bit more that might not, they might not actually say something that might actually lead to a better diagnosis. Secondly, patients are more likely to also follow the treatment plan if they feel they've been listened to or treated with a little bit of kindness. You know, I saw what you're talking about, both sides of this. I lost my dad a couple of years ago. He'd had a brain tumour and glioblastoma multiforme, wow. totally
horrible,
random for
horrible.
My dad. It was like, Dad was late, you know, 78 when he was diagnosed, healthiest person I knew. And I saw both sides in that. I saw immense compassion and kindness from certain staff, and I saw complete clinicalness and coldness from some others. And it was, you know, it was very, very contradictory. I have to say, the vast majority of people my dad and the family interacted with was incredibly compassionate and kind. The vast majority, I have to state that. But there was a few pockets of that where it was literally the absence, complete absence of that. And the thing is that the absence of it does have a very painful effect.
It does.
On the family as well as on
it
my
does,
dad.
It does, yeah. Well, and also due to the army-like structure that it operates in, it's, unfortunately, it's quite often the people at the top that exhibit the worst kind of clinical lack of care. And because they have a lot of influence, if Mr. Big comes along, Mr. Oncologist, and says, well, you've had it, you know, then it does carry a lot of weight, unfortunately.
That's exactly what happened within our family. My dad was actually doing quite well for someone in his condition. And then a consultant came on the phone to my mum and raised his voice and prescribed something for my dad at a dose, at a level that my dad really shouldn't have needed to be on. And even his main oncologist expressed doubt, saying that's supposed to be brought in very, very slowly, not just like that amount right there and then. And it just knocked my dad out. And my dad wasn't ever... Literally, my dad's health just went dramatically downhill. And I remember the guy shouting at my mum on the phone, I am the doctor, I decide what... And he hadn't even seen my dad. And it was so painful. And I wished I was there. I would have spoken to him as well. But it was, he hadn't seen my dad. He was looking at something he had in his desk, you know, forms that had been filled in. But had he seen my dad, he would have saw my dad was presenting quite differently from someone you're reading a piece of paper about. My dad was presenting entirely different, which was why his main oncology consultant was quite surprised at my dad had been dumped on a really high level of an anti-seizure medication that really should have been tapered up very, very slowly. And what it did, because it was high dose right away, it literally knocked my dad out. And all the things we were trying to do from an integrative perspective just went out the window,
right,
because my dad wasn't able to do anything else now after that. So we saw immense compassion, but also the what seemed to be the absence of it.
Yeah.
At the same time.
Yeah. No, it's very difficult. You know, talk about sort of nocebo effect. That's it, really. And equally powerful to the placebo effect, of course. So really, you know, to me, okay, you can sit here and you can talk, you can actually produce science for lots of the things that we're supporting and advocating for in integrative medicine. That I can guarantee that oncologist who pronounced that prescription for your dad without even meeting him doesn't know anything about any of it, and it's the kind of science which is excluded from his repertoire and his interest. He doesn't want to know about it, in fact. And, you know, that's what I was describing in terms of a kind of a particular view of science, which excludes an awful lot of things. You know, it's a very narrow view of kind of fundamentalist science, I think of it as. And so, coming back to this thing about bridging the gap between science and spirituality. As you move towards spirituality, you embrace more and more of the aspects of care, which are less tangible, less drug-based, all the rest of it, and less fit, even less into this category of fundamentalist science.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, it's that thing that quite accepted fundamentalist science is kind of propping up the army base of our healthcare is part of the masonry.
Yeah, and here's something, Robin. This is something I find when people become more aware of some really high-level, powerful signs about kindness, it begins to shift, produce cracks in it. And previous, well, let me share you a study, a randomized controlled trial, 182 people, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, just a couple of years ago. They randomized people into three groups. One group were asked to do three acts of kindness on one day of the week, per week for a month. So three acts of kindness, let's say, suppose it was today, then you would do three acts of kindness today, and then three acts of kindness next week on the same day. So over the month, it was 12 acts of kindness. The second group were asked to do three acts of kindness for themselves per week for the month. So 12 acts of kindness for others versus 12 acts of kindness for yourself versus just take a note of events, daily events, which were the control group. Incredibly, those who'd done kindness for others, when the researchers took blood samples at the beginning and after the 12 weeks, there was an impact on the genetic activity of circulating immune cells in the bloodstream, leukocytes, white blood cells, in the bloodstream, an impact in a way that was anti-inflammatory and bolstering the body's natural antiviral activity. Isn't that extraordinary?
Okay.
Being kind to others impacted the genetic activity of immune cells in the bloodstream. They titled it Kindness in the Blood. Isn't that extraordinary?
Right. It is extraordinary.
Randomized controlled trial.
Yeah. But it makes complete sense. I mean, just in experiential terms, you want a feel-good thing. I mean, do something good for somebody. It makes you feel great,
absolutely,
doesn't it?
And that little moment of connection that you feel that great feeling. When you're kind and you mean it, and the key is, Robin, and you'll know this from your own experience, you have to mean it.
Yes.
And I call this nature's catch-22. If you're kind and you don't mean it, you don't really get any of the physiological effects, because the physiological effects come through your internal experience of kindness, that way it feels, the way you described a moment ago, that felt connection you get with another person, that momentary sense of meaning or that momentary sense of connection you get. It's the internal experience of kindness that leads to the physiological effects, the those effects in the blood, in the immune system, in the bloodstream, the neurological effects that impact particular parts of the brain that dial down stress and actually dial up positive feelings in the brain that actually have a physical effect on the blood vessels, to expand blood vessels and reduce blood pressure. These things are due to the internal experience of what kindness is like for you. So when you're kind and you mean it, you're doing it on purpose because you feel this person's suffering. I care. And I'm going to show them that I care. I'm going to listen. I'm going to talk to them in a gentle way. I'm going to try and understand them. And in those moments, you're having that felt experience, and your brain and your body say, okay, then, here we go. And your brain says, here's a high five, thank you for being so kind, here's a little squirt of happy hormones, and here's a little squirt of stuff within your body that acts on your heart, your blood vessels, your immune system, various aspects of the aging process itself. And that's pretty much what happens when you have that internal experience of caring.
Amazing.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
That thing about really meaning it is interesting, isn't it? Because actually, when I think across the whole gamut of strategies that you do, as someone with cancer wanting to get well, really meaning it, whatever it is actually, whether it's having chemo or whether it's doing an exercise program or whatever, the really meaning it part of it is, I think is kind of fundamental as well. It's like, yeah, it makes it 100 times more effective.
Yeah. And you know, really meaning it, that has its roots in empathy. And empathy is something that can be trained.
Yeah.
You know, empathy, the brain is highly neuroplastic, meaning it's moldable and changeable. And empathy centers of the brain are neuroplastic. In other words, we can learn empathy by, you know, sometimes it's by understanding, by being willing to understand how someone's suffering and what life is like. You know, they say, try to imagine what it's like in someone else's shoes. What that really means is to imagine what it's like for someone. And see, the more we practice imagining what it's like for a person, empathy actually naturally grows. In the brain, empathy centers begin to activate and begin to undergo physical change. And the more we do this, empathy actually becomes something, because of the changes in the brain, it becomes more accessible to us. And so the more you do empathy, the more you just ask, I wonder what it's like for that person. It might not, if you've not done it much before initially, it might not feel any different. But see, after you've done it a dozen or 20 or 30 times, you start to actually feel what it's like for people. This is the basis of compassion-based meditation practices, where you, and essentially what you're doing is you're contemplating what it's like for a person, and then you're wishing them, you're sending a silent wish for them. May you be happy and well and free of your suffering. You know, I wonder what it's like for this person. And we just send them a wee silent prayer. It doesn't have to be a religious prayer. It can just be, I hope everything works out for you. I really hope you have a nice day, or I hope something positive or meaningful happens. Maybe even you get a compliment from someone today, or someone gives you a hug or shows you a bit of compassion today. It doesn't have to be religious. It just has to be something that has its basis in empathy or compassion.
Amazing. All right. So kindness, clearly an obsession for you, but a parallel theme of equal importance is the circularity of kindness. So you've just been describing it there, but you've dedicated an entire book, I noticed, to the subject of self-love. So that's a surprisingly thorny issue for a lot of people in my experience. You give a lot of attention to the effects of being kind, but how is it central to an authentic expression of our humanity and therefore our well-being?
Because I think when we can be, as humans, I think many people are so genuinely compassionate and kind, and we do kindness a lot, but sometimes to the detriment of ourselves,
right,
of our own mental and physical health. And what that means is we are tirelessly looking after everyone, running after everyone, and forgetting that we need to plug ourselves in. Even superheroes need to recharge from time to time. You know, Superman has to absorb the sun's rays or he'll be exhausted, you know. And so self-kind or self-love or self-kindness is just recognizing that I also matter. And for me to be able to be present for the people in my life in meaningful ways, I also must take care of myself, my mental health and my physical health. Not instead of them. It's not about, when I was first writing a book on this, I came across a lot of people thinking, well, how can you be kind to yourself? Because the idea was I have to be kind to myself instead of that person. That person. It's not about, there's no sequence to it. It's just recognizing at times I have needs that I have to look after so that I can be present for people. Sometimes, you know, we've got lots of energy and the self-kindness doesn't need to take a front row seat. But other times, you know, we're much further down the line of feeling tired and worn out. And then self-kindness needs to dominate the practice. It needs to take a front row seat, just so that we can charge our batteries enough so that we're able to be present. And what I often say is try to find that middle ground so that you're regularly looking after yourself, you're regularly supporting your own mental and physical health to a level that, in other words, you're aware of your needs and act on them enough that you never slip down to feeling exhausted and tired kind of thing. So there's that kind of sweet spot somewhere in the middle that's in a different place for each person, because it depends on your life. It depends on the context of your life, where you are, even what how your life has gone before now.
Yeah, very true. Yeah, I mean, it's often I talk with people who've got cancer about the fact, well, okay, you're in a place where the moment is to move the attention way over towards yourself, in fact, and that's just natural and key about survival. It's absolutely right.
Yeah.
I feel we're kind of in the backwash again of some religious ideas where it's been sort of selfishness has been seen as bad press, selflessness, good press. And so therefore that puts us at the back of the queue always. And of course, I think what you're saying is that, of course, we're no more or less important than anybody else.
Absolutely.
But we don't treat ourselves that way, do we, generally?
No.
Most people, well, there's a few people who put themselves at the front of the queue every time, but most people actually put themselves at the back of the queue every time. And hence they end up depleted in spiritual and physical and all sorts of ways,
And that's why I try to present it as self-kindness is something you do as well as. Not instead of or before than or afterwards other people. It's as well as being kind to other people. And then it doesn't feel as selfish, because you're not saying I'm putting myself first all the time. You're just saying as I'm going to look after myself as well as looking after other people. Exactly how and when you do that depends on you. It depends on the context of your life, you know, how things are unfolding. But just to be aware that you do have needs, and it's really important that you look after yourself, that you act on those needs, you find a way, not before that person or after that person or any particular sequence, just as well as. And I think that as well as gets that middle ground. And then you're not over there and you're not arguing, saying it's all about me or it's all about them. It's not about polarization. It's as well as.
Right.
I look after myself as well as looking after others.
Complete sense, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so on to your most recent book, which has got the, let's say, provocative title of The Joy of Actually Giving a Fuck. And you describe giving a fuck as being revolutionary in a world where apathy reigns. So what would you say is the source of that apathy? And was it always so, or is this a modern malaise?
I think I can almost a modern malaise. I think in some pockets it's always been there, but I think maybe a bit of a modern malaise. And what I try to do is raise awareness of the science of kindness and how it actually benefits, but also how it benefits society, like in terms of having a ripple effect, you know, in terms of making a difference in people's lives, but what consequences of that can be. So investigating the science of kindness from all different perspectives. And so what's revolutionary, what I was referring to there, is if you understand that kindness really is something we are genetically wired for, and here are all the different physiological effects, then we realize that we're not supposed to be apathetic to people suffering. We're supposed to care. We're supposed to give an F kind of thing. And that's really how I approach the subject. We're supposed to be like this. And here's all, and if you need evidence for it, here is all the signs of how kindness impacts your brain, your mental health, your heart, your immune system, your blood vessels, your aging process, all these different things. And here's what it means. And here's how to do it in varying different scenarios.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, great topic. Well, look, in a way, what you're saying there is that, yeah, it is our true nature to be this way, and brings me right into our conferences, which are called Reclaiming Our True Nature, what science is telling us about the impact of psychological, emotional and spiritual factors on survivorship. I'm absolutely over the moon that you're going to be speaking at our in-person conference in the autumn. Your presentation, The Healthy Side Effects of Kindness, I'm sure it's going to get the day after a rocket start. So really looking forward to that. But these two programs are all around this whole territory we've been talking about today, which I think it's just taken a massive leap forward to me in the last few months. I don't know why, but, you know, the status that people are giving to areas, you know, looking into investigating the psychological, the emotional, the spiritual, and how much impact they really have in real terms in the world has suddenly rocketed. And I'm very glad to be riding the wave with our conferences. And I think it's hugely, hugely important to people. And an awful lot of people are out there dying to order in a rather depressing system, you know, which is there's a lot of that apathy there in oncology. Oh, yeah, they're going to die anyway. You know, that's it, isn't there? And so we've got to look at this thing head on, and we've got to see, well, what is it that makes people thrive and survive, even with the worst possible diagnosis? Yeah. It's extraordinary what can happen. So, these two events, I exhort anyone who's been affected by cancer in any way, a loved one, or even as a cancer care professional, come along, find out what's happening, listen to David. So huge thanks for joining me today, David. I think it's brilliant what we talked about.
It's been my pleasure, Robert. And you know, I have to say, it's amazing what you're doing, the work you're doing. It's so incredibly meaningful and so incredibly helpful for people. I mean, incredibly, incredibly helpful. I wish that when my dad was unwell a few years back, I wish we knew more about what you talk about and what you're promoting. I wish we knew more then, that, you know, like we know now. I wish we knew a little bit more of that just a few years ago.
Well, I can say the same. For helping my daughter, but it's very important, and I'm glad I had these two sort of things. My daughter died, as you may know, and I came away with two things. And one of them was about, I knew there's a huge range of stuff out there. There's lots of choice, and people were just not being offered it. And I thought, got to do something about that. The other one was this absence of love, this need for love in the whole arena of cancer care. There needs to be far more love. And I, at the time I made this choice, I thought, well, I can't do both these massive things. So I went off, first of all, for the first 20 years down the choice thing. And I've been promoting choice, promoting choice, promoting choice. But more recently, I suddenly realized, well, actually, they're the same thing. They're both the same thing. That, as we were talking about, that bridging the gap between spirituality and science means bringing in choice, means bringing in integrative care, and it also means bringing in kindness and love.
Absolutely.
These are all the same thing. Yeah. And so I'm full on with the whole lot now.
Yeah. Good for you. Good for you.
Yeah. Wonderful to talk. Really enlightening and enlivening, David. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too.
Take care then.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
I'm so delighted that we have David as one of our distinguished speakers at our Yes to Life conferences this year. He's going to be joined in making the case for a kinder, more compassionate cancer care by other leaders in the field, such as Dr. Nasha Winters, Raj Jana, James Maskell, Dr. Leo Broomboom, Professor Paul Diep, Dr. Larry Sherwitz, and many, many more. More than 20, in fact. To find out more and to book, go to conference.yestolife.org.uk, where you can still scoop up an early bird ticket. And to find out more about Dr. David Hamilton's work, his website can be found at drdavidhamilton.com, that's drdavidhamilton.com. There you can find out about his books and his courses, read his blog posts, sign up for his daily boost emails or members-only website, or link to his social media channels. Thanks so much for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed hearing from Dr. Hamilton and will want to find out more by coming to our conference on the 26th of September in London. Meanwhile, I'll be back again next week with another episode of the Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.